I don't know whether I'm going to put it in the real thing. Well, yeah, the rants you got to be present for too, because I only just hit the record button. Let's see. Oh, just curious. How far are you with Dumbledore, Elfangor? It's not like I super need it right now or anything. I'm just sort of wondering, because I know it's a fucking chunk of change. I know you got done with, yeah, and yeah, okay. I knew you were into book three, because you mentioned, well, I mean, you mentioned that you'd gotten to the part where he gets petrified. That isn't all he has to say in book two, but it's most of it. Yeah. I know there are parts. It's kind of stupid, because it's like there are parts of Dumbledore's performance in the recording that I'm not going to change, but I want to have a version of it that I know is good for all of it, because his voice matters a lot, you know? So I want to have a file that I can go to if I that's very helpful. I don't remember whether you were in here when I found a McGonagall line that I did not do. That was yesterday or the day before. I think it was yesterday, because it was Minerva, not McGonagall. Luckily, after that Scottish boot camp, I can kind of bust that voice out when I super need to. Okay, I've dithered for long enough. Chapter 40. Endgame, Part 1. Trigger warning. Spiders. You know what? I'm gonna leave it in, because it sounds cheeky. You know? It sounds like the chapter heading or something. It's like, trigger warning spiders. It's trigger warning spiders. You know, like it's like, yeah, you want spiders? We got spiders for you. Oh my God. I have one more ramble, and then I'm gonna start the chapter. Okay. I'm sure everyone in here has heard of the band, the Insane Clown Posse. Yes. I'm sure. There can't be anyone that hasn't, right? And by extension, approximately what Juggalos are. Actually, if anyone doesn't know what Juggalos are, tell me and I'll explain what Juggalos are. That's the one, yeah. So, they have a yearly convention, I guess, called the Gathering of the Juggalos, right? And, it's kind of like Juggalo Woodstock or whatever. And from what I understand, Juggalos are kind of a misunderstood species. That it's really easy to make fun of them, but like for the most part, they're just like really fun-loving people that like are united in their love of an absolutely terrible fucking band, and they just like want to have fun, and like they're like actually pretty fucking nice. Actually, a minor sub ramble. I remember comedian Mike Schmidt told a story on his podcast where he used to be, a bouncer, and like he would run like security and stuff as a day job. He's a big fucking guy, and he was doing security at a ICP concert, and there's like. Juggalos are fucking nuts, right? So the people that ran the venue, apparently the venue, there were these curtains on the side, and the curtains were like they were irreplaceable. They were worth hundreds of thousands of dollars for whatever reason. Like like, you know, the like antique, they've been around for fucking ever. They were a big like sort of feature of the venue, and the people that that run it, like, they told all the security guys, don't let any of the fans near the fucking curtains. Like, you, they cannot damage the curtains. This is like the most important part of your job tonight. And you know, like, we're gonna say something to the band, but you know, Juggalos kind of thing. So like, that's not, you know. So when the band got on stage, they did like their whole like, you know, greeting or whatever. But before they even played any music, they all went, all right now, everybody, no, you see these curtains? No one fuck with these curtains, all right? They're off limits. Fuck those curtains. Just watch us. And not a single fucking person touched them. I think it's really fucking special. Like, that says, that is my opinion of Juggalos right there. Because other than that, they're like, they're fucking crazy. Like, they're throwing like Faygo around everywhere. They're being fucking animals. Not a single person got anywhere near the curtains. Like, the security didn't have to watch it at all. No one got close. But the other thing is that if you ever want a good time, go on YouTube and find the yearly infomercials for the gathering of the Juggalos. Because they are amazing. And as someone who is into, and to an extent does professionally, voiceover work, they always get a voiceover guy and they make him say the most amazing things. Like, a sample line, and then I'll get to the fucking thing, but like, a sample line is like, we're gonna be rocking you guys all around the motherfucking Klizzok, and shit like that. And it's like a totally professional VO guy, probably like one step down from like, you know, movie trailer guy, like those like five dudes that do all the trailers. Anyway, gathering of the Juggalos. I think it's like Gathering of the Juggalos, like 2009 or 2011 or something is the one that I always watch. But like, and if you want midgets, we've got midgets for you. Like, it's so fucking amazing. I don't even know if midgets offensive. I have no idea. I've never known which words for like little people is like actually offensive. But if midgets is offensive, I apologize. I genuinely don't know. But okay. I'm just gonna say the titles again because then I'm not gonna edit to that. Chapter 40, Endgame, Part 1. Trigger warning. Spiders. Meh. Note to self, it was cleaner earlier. Fuck it, you already got the take. Okay. The astonishing revelations from earlier that afternoon that Gilderoy Lockhart, A, was a dark wizard, B, who confessed before witnesses to engineering both the petrifications and the locker room prank on the Slytherins, C, before dramatically fleeing Hogwarts, sent shockwaves through the school. At the evening meal, acting headmistress McGonagall made all the relevant announcements, most importantly that the school was no longer in danger of being shut down, since the person responsible had been removed for good. Naturally, this led to uproarious applause from the student body, and especially from the Gryffindors, when it was announced that Fred Weasley would be returning to the... When it was announced that Fred Weasley would be returning the following morning. Dinner was followed by one of Gryffindor's legendary parties. Oliver Wood was in high spirits over the news that the Gryffindor-Hufflepuff match had been rescheduled for later in the month. Several of the Gryffindors who had openly accused Jim of being the heir of Slytherin came to apologize, albeit grudgingly, and Jim thanked them politely but tersely, in a way that suggested that the matter was forgiven but decidedly not forgotten. And he wasn't even that magnanimous. And he wasn't even that magnanimous to housemates like Cormac McLagan, who he'd hurt. Ah. And he wasn't even that magnanimous to housemates like Cormac McLagan, who he'd overheard saying, "Oh, God." I literally have to, like, read the sentence to myself and put all the vowels in the right spot. At least his brother Harry was out there trying to do something helpful, even if he got into trouble for it. I still say they got sorted wrong. Yeah. I still say they got sorted wrong. It's kind of crap, but I might read it later. Unfortunately, Jim didn't even have the chance. Unfortunately, Jim didn't even have the choice of whether to forgive Ron or not. His former friend just gave him a quick glare from across the common room before running upstairs without a word. And the saddest part was that after everything, Jim thought he probably would forgive Ron and... Jim thought he probably would forgive Ron in an instant, if only the boy would show the common decency to just apologize for the way he'd been acting. Much later, after everyone else had gone to bed, Ron sat in his bed with the diary of Tom Marvolo Riddle clenched in his hands.
Let me go,
he whispered over and over to himself for hours, but no one ever responded.
I see Dorian is typing. Get in the call.
There had also been a rather more subdued party in the Slytherin dungeons that night. Once the twin threats of petrification and school closure had apparently been dealt with, Harry's rivals in the house turned their attention to loudly blaming him and Theo for the late-term loss of 50 house points. Harry, of course, couldn't care less about the lost house points, and withdrew from the common room to the lair with barely a glance towards Cassius Warrington and Miranda Bonnevie, who had both recently moved up the rankings on Harry's personal to-do list. Later, after the startling discovery that Harry had intentionally allowed Gilderoy Lockhart to block almost 4.5 minutes of their conversation from his memories, the three young Slytherins spent another hour in Harry's pensive, reviewing the scene to find the gap. On the fourth repetition, Blaise spotted it. Just before James Potter blasted the door off its hinges, and while Lockhart was laughing maniacally, there was the very slightest hiccup in the playback. During one of Lockhart's demented laughs, his body position changed fractionally but instantaneously. Equally telling was when Theo looked out the window and noticed a bird flying by some distance away. At the exact instant of the hiccup, the bird instantly jumped a distance of what looked to be at least... The bird instantly jumped a distance of what looked to be at least a mile. Oh, so I do have more, like a good scene of Lockhart, because I know we do get to see the rest of those memories. Blah. Unfortunately, knowing where the gap was provided no knowledge of what took place during it. According to Blaze, who had spent most of the year studying memory charms in Team Recall, it was absolutely impossible to recover memories sealed with a memory lock unless the one who placed it somehow arranged for the recipient to receive the unlock code. Harry remembered the code he picked for Mr. X, the one about Voldemort that he hoped he'd never... The one about Voldemort that he hoped he'd never need to use. Presumably, Lockhart would communicate the code to him at some point, but he wasn't required to, and he might well choose to keep his secret forever. Indeed, if the Aurors got to him before he sent Harry the code, the memory might be lost forever, regardless of what he wanted. Tired and annoyed, Harry and his friends left the lair around midnight, just as the party was dying down. Near the entry point for Prefect's Row, they encountered Miranda Bonnevie, who was waiting for them with her arms crossed and a smug expression on her face.
Damn it to hell, what does she sound like? Was it like especially prissy RP? Is that what she was? Like almost Umbridge-y? Am I remembering that correctly? I don't know why you guys would remember how Miranda fucking Bonnevie talked. I think it was prissy. It was like.
Dick.
Well, 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 she sneered. It's the little second years who thought they could catch the DADA instructor. What are you three always doing back there anyway? Flint and Bulstrode just let you three have the run of the place. It's pitiful. And then she seems to sneer even harder.
I'm not sure that's how she sounds. I'm going to pause it for a second and find the last time she spoke. Oh yeah, no, I actually have to get back to the chapter I was on. There's 9 chapters left in book fucking 2. That's like ridiculous, right?
Then she seems to sneer even harder. Harry turns to his friends. Why is it that everyone in this house is always sneering at something? It's very off-putting. Plus, it loses its.
Raise the mic.
It's very off-putting. Plus, it loses its effectiveness if you do it all the time. You there. Pass me the salt and pepper.
Harry gave an exaggerated sneer to accentuate that last command.
We should do something about that. Bonnevie scoffed. Well, whatever you're doing back there, you can forget about it when I'm 70. Well, whatever you're doing back there, you can forget about it when I'm 7 years. Well, whatever you're doing back there, you can forget about it when I'm 7th-year prefect. I've got a lot of changes in store for next year. She took a step forward. And that includes putting a few people who don't know their place back into it. Harry studied the girl, and then slowly smiled. Look around the room, Bonnevie. He gestured around the nearly empty chamber. Go on, look. What do you see? She looked around carefully. Just the common room. Right. Now I want you to spend the next few minutes studying this room and committing it to memory. Why? She asked warily. So that years from now, you can look back and remember this exact second as the moment when everything went horribly wrong. Good night, Bonnevie. With that, the three boys swept past the furious prefect and headed up to their rooms. 9 May, 1993, 8 o'clock a.m.
Bins!
I'm going to be honest. I'm actually really worried about how long the books of Princess Slytherin are getting. Because it's almost approaching exponential growth at this point. Like, it's not that I mind. Like, I'm not saying it's like a fault in the writing. I'm just saying I'm worried about it getting finished, you know?
When Harry awoke early the next morning, he first made his way to the library to look up the Colportus Trimendium spell, as it was one he never plans to be on the wrong side of again. That accomplished, he made his way down to the Great Hall for breakfast, where the entire room was abuzz with excitement. Harry couldn't feel any excitement himself. Harry couldn't feel any excitement himself, of course. His detention would begin after lunch, 3 hours of a lo- Three hours of a lovely Sunday afternoon spent shoveling dragon dung into pots for the final mandrake repotting prior to their harvest at the end of the month. While he and his peers no longer had to deal with the annoying and dangerous little plants directly, Harry thought that might be preferable to handling what was considered the smelliest, most disgusting form of animal waste known to wizard kind. As soon as Harry walked into the Great Hall, Marcus Flint called out to him.
Potter, have you seen the Prophet yet?
Nope. Anything interesting? Flint scoffed and then handed his copy to the boy who'd opened... it to the front page.
That's not how front pages work. Right? You can't open a newspaper to the front page, right? I'm just gonna say looked at. But why would it be folded in half in a way that you would have to open to read the front page? No.
Flint scoffed and then handed his copy to the boy, who looked at the front page and immediately started coughing at it. Flint scoffed and then handed his copy to the boy, who looked at the front page and immediately started
and immediately started coughing at the headline. Sunday Prophet Special Edition. Insane Gilderoy Lockhart captured. Confesses to being heir of Slytherin before magically... Confesses to being heir of Slytherin before magically lobotomizing self. Below the headline was a picture of the man himself in a straitjacket, staring vacantly at the camera with a loop. Staring vacantly at the camera with a loopy grin on his face and a bit of drool slipping down his chin. Harry sat down to read the story in all its lurid glory. Apparently, after evading a nationwide manhunt, or wizard hunt as it were, the man showed up early that morning, just before dawn at the... The man showed up early that morning just before dawn at the offices of the Daily Prophet in disheveled clothes and carrying a large valise. There he held the weekend staff members at one point for nearly 20 minutes while he gave a long, rambling, but surprisingly thorough confession to the only reporter in the building, a sports columnist who was on hand typing up his commentary on the previous day's Tutshill Tornadoes Holyhead Harpies match. Lockhart claimed responsibility for the... petrifications and the Heir of Slytherin graffiti, which he said was part of his plan to get the school closed because those weak-minded fools didn't appreciate his genius. He also took credit for a malicious prank that nearly led to the deaths of the entire Slytherin Quidditch team, and he confessed to a... And he confessed to illegally using memory charms to erase the memories of dozens of people so that he could take credit for their heroic exploits in what he had falsely claimed were autobiographical books. Last but not least, he also confessed to using memory charms to rob people or for other purposes, which the newspaper would not reveal to protect the innocence of its young readers. Finally, as Aurors drew near to the scene, the cheerful lunatic gave one last jaunty ha-ha before placing his wands to his t- oh, no, no, no. If it's the last one, I'm doing right. The cheerful lunatic gave one last jaunty ha-ha before placing his wands to his temple and uttering an obscure memory charm so powerful that it left him nearly catatonic. According to medical examination, this state was completely irreversible, as this version of the memory charm was the one used in certain foreign countries as a form of non-lethal capital punishment. As a form of non-lethal capital punishment known as death of personality. After confirming the man's permanent incapacity, the Aurors reported that the valise he'd brought with him contains nothing but his last will and testament, which left everything to his longtime manservant, an elderly squib of eight. An elderly squib of Asian descent named Cato, as well as drafts of his final DADA exam. For all 7 years of Hogwarts students. The Aurors transported Lockhart to the Janice Thickey long-term care ward at St. Mungo's Hospital, where he would remain until such time as the Wizengamot ruled on the legality of trying a criminal...
of trying a criminal defendant completely of trying a criminal defendant completely unable to understand what he was on trial for, as well as the ethics of sending someone to Azkaban who had been reduced to the mental age of a newborn. Ironically, Lockhart himself had recently donated thousands... Ironically, Lockhart himself had recently donated thousands of... Ironically, Lockhart himself had recently donated thousands of galleons to the Janus Thicke ward out of... Ironically, Lockhart himself had recently donated... Ironically, Lockhart himself had recently donated thousands of galleons to the Janus Thicke ward out of proceeds from special charity reprints of several of his books. Now it was possible he would spend the rest of his life there. Yeah. Now it was possible he would spend the rest of his life there. Harry sat down to the table as he absorbed the information. Between the memory lock, which suggested that he talked peacefully with Lockhart for over 4 minutes in the man's quarters, and the bizarrely over-the-top confessions that Lockhart made both before the end of the... And the bizarrely over-the-top confessions that Lockhart made both before at the scene and later to the Prophet reporters, Harry was now convinced that Lockhart was innocent of the various crimes of which he'd confessed. Well, some of them at least. Harry thought that Lockhart definitely gave a false confession to clear Fred Weasley's name and also to delay the heir of Slytherin's efforts to close the school. Unfortunately, Harry had no proof for that theory, and if Lockhart was a permanent amnesiac... He'd never get any. Suddenly, he was distracted from his musings, but now. Suddenly, he was distracted from his musings by a mighty cheer that rose up from the Gryffindor table. Fred Weasley had just entered the hall to a standing ovation from his house, followed by hugs from each of his siblings in turn. As Harry observed the Weasley children bonding together, he noticed as Ron and Ginny bumped into each other somewhat awkwardly. Then, impulsively, Ginny pulled Ron into a hug as well. And after a moment's hesitation, Ron hugged her back with a tentative affection. I'm not nearly as tired as I was last night, though. Harry was pleased to see Ginny. Harry was pleased to see Ginny and Ron getting over their differences after he took a few seconds to purge himself of any slight feelings of jealousy of Weasley family. After he took a few seconds to purge himself of any slight feelings of jealousy of the Weasley family's relative closeness, he also spared a glance towards Jim, who was watching the Weasleys reconnect with a warm smile and somewhat misty eyes. Shaking off the impulse towards mawkishness that was suddenly rising within him, Harry turned back to the Daily Prophet. This is a rough session, guys. I apologize.
Gryffindor Tower, 9:30 a.m. Ron banged furiously on the door of the room shared by Jim and Neville, but there was no answer. He'd seen both boys leave the Great Hall at around the same time. Surely one of them would be here by now. Of course, he had something in his possession that would let him know exactly where Jim and Neville were, but he had been afraid to open his bag and... check the map, because the map was right next to the book. There was only one book in Ron's life worthy of capital letters. He'd been calling it a notebook, but it wasn't even... But it wasn't as though Ron had used it for that purpose all year long. But now, perhaps when it was too late, Ron had finally realized that it had used him more than the other way around. An hour earlier, while in the embrace of his siblings, an unexpected surge of positive emotions cut through the cobwebs that had been clogging his mind for most of the past year. He didn't know how long this clarity would last, and so, in his desperation, he seized upon an almost infantile belief that formed within him when he was a small child, and which had comforted him ever since, that whenever there was evil afoot, the boy who lived would be on hands to save the day. Unfortunately, the boy who lived wasn't in at the moment, and no one was there to answer the door. Ron looked up and down the corridor and saw that no one was coming. Grimacing, he dropped down to one knee and carefully opened his bag. Gently, he tried to pull the map out without touching the black book, but despite his best efforts, his fingers grazed against its soft leather cover. Ron blinked, and suddenly he was tightly holding the book in his hands instead of the map he'd meant to pull out. He squeezed his eyes shut and tried to block out that terrible hissing that somehow was at once both inaudible and deafening. He felt something in the back of his mind that tried to dredge up the feelings of jealousy, insecurity, and anger that had all... Jealousy, insecurity, and anger that had festered in him for years. But for once he could fight back. He focused on the feeling of love he felt when Fred walked into the Great Hall, and the even greater surge of it he felt when Ginny hugged him and let him know that she still cared about him even after how awful he'd been to her this year. This mind snake hissed angrily. Ron opened his eyes. The book was still in his hands, and he knew he couldn't resist it for long. He looked over at the door to Jim's room. There was a gap between the floor and the bottom of the door. He took a deep breath and shoved the notebook underneath the door and into Jim's room.
"He'll know what to do. He's the boy who lived. He'll know what to do."
Ron thought those words over and over like a mantra to drown out the now furious hissing going on in his head. Then he heard someone coming up the stairs. Quickly he grabbed the bag. Quickly, he grabbed his bag, jumped up, and scrambled further up the stairwell towards Percy's private study room. Just a few seconds behind him, Jim came up the stairs, dispelled the locking boards on his room, and entered, closing the door behind him.
There's
Immediately upon entering his dorm room, Jim struck the black notebook with his foot, and it slid across the floor. Surprised, Jim stepped over and picked it up to examine it. He recognized it, of course. Ron had never been without the notebook into which he had faithfully scribbled everything from class notes. Ron had never been without the notebook into which he had faithfully scribbled everything from class notes to daily schedules to doodles of Gilderoy Lockhart with a comically giant head. But to Jim's surprise, when he flipped through the book now, its pages were blank. He turned back to the cover to inspect it and noticed for the very first time that it had a name. That it had a name engraved on it. Tom Marvolo Riddle. The name was familiar to Jim, and after a few seconds he recalled Hagrid mentioning Tom as a good friend back during his school days, the one who mistakenly thought Hagrid was the original heir of Slytherin and who had inadvertently gotten him expelled as a result. But how did Ron get hold of the man's diary 50 years later? His curiosity overcoming his caution, Jim sat down with the book at a writing desk and opened it again. Then he took out a quill and an inkpot and started to write, only to pause before the quill touched the page. Why am I writing in this suspiciously empty journal that just appeared in my room, and which obviously has something... to do with the petrifications from back in 1943, and possibly something to do with... why Ron's been acting like a complete prat for these last 9 months. The boy wavered for a few seconds until a single drop of ink fell from the quill onto the blank page below, where it was instantly absorbed completely. Jim gasped at the sudden sensation of something, and before he could form a coherent thought in response, his fears and cautiousness melted away, while a strong sense of curiosity about the book blossomed and took root. But it wouldn't hurt to test this thing just a little, I suppose. Guided by that impulse, Jim set his quill against the faded paper. My name is Jim Potter. The ink quickly faded away to be replaced by another message in response. Hello, Jim Potter. My name is Tom Riddle. That message faded too, leaving a blank page. Excited and heedless of the faint warning bells in the back of his head, Jim wrote again. Do you know anything about the heir of Slytherin? The ink faded, and a single word materialized and then vanished. Yes. Jim's heart rate sped up in excitement. Can you tell me? No.
But I can show you.
Jim dropped the quill in surprise as an unearthly... Jim dropped the quill in surprise as an unearthly glow... Jim dropped the quill in surprise as an unearthly glow erupted from the seam of the open pages, enveloping him in its... enveloping him in its light. The next thing he knew, he was standing in a different part of Hogwarts, near the main foyer, and it was suddenly night. Whirling around in confusion, Jim suddenly noticed someone he didn't recognize approaching. It was an older boy, a fifth year, judging by the prefect's pin on his Slytherin robes. Excuse me, do you know how I got here? The other boy made no sign of having heard him, and when Jim reached out as the other boy... And when Jim reached out as the other boy passed, his hand passed right... His hand passed right through the boy's arm as if it were intangible. Shocked, Jim followed the boy down the darkened corridor. He paused at the edge of the stairs leading up to the second floor. Coming down from the second floor were several DMLE officials transporting a levitating stretcher. Jim shuddered. On the stretcher was a body with a On the stretcher was a body with a sheet over it, female from the look of the hand sticking out.
Metal Warren, Jim said softly. Metal Warren, Jim said softly. Then he heard a voice call out,
Riddle!
He followed the He followed the older boy, who was obviously Tom Riddle himself, up the stairs, where he was surprised to see a much younger Dumbledore. Relatively speaking, he looked to be about 60 at the top.
Professor Dumbledore, Tom replied before ascending the stairs with a humble...
Tom replied before ascending the stairs with a humble expression. It is not wise to be wandering around this late hour, Tom. Dumbledore said. Jim was surprised by the slight coldness in the man's voice as he spoke.
Maybe he mellowed with age, Jim thought to himself. Yes, Professor, Tom said respectfully. I suppose I had to see for myself if the rumors were true.
I'm afraid they are, Tom. They are.
About the school as well? I don't really have a home to go to. They wouldn't really close Hogwarts, would they, Professor?
I understand, Tom, Dumbledore said more gently. But I'm afraid Headmaster Dippet may have no choice.
Sir, Tom said slowly, if it all stopped, if the person responsible was caught...
Dumbledore's eyes narrowed, and to Jim's surprise, he took a step back from the boy.
Is there something you wish to tell me, Tom? He asked with obvious suspicion.
Instantly, Tom's face registered complete innocence.
No, sir, nothing.
Dumbledore stared at the boy for a long time before speaking.
Very good, then, he said quietly. Off you go.
Good night, sir, Tom said with a respectful nod before leaving Dumbledore.
It's the kind of voice I really didn't spend too much time thinking about for Tom Riddle, but I think it's just like, that's what Tom Riddle should sound like.
Jim followed, and to his surprise, The Slytherin the Slytherin headed off not towards the dungeons, but towards Gryffindor Tower, and eventually to a forgotten set of rooms several floors below it. Tom paused at a door and drew his wand. Then he took a deep breath and threw the door open. Instantly, Jim realized that it was the private room of Rubeus Hagrid, currently a third-year student, segregated from the rest. Of his house due to bigotry against his half-giant heritage. Tom entered the room and pointed his wand at Hagrid just as he slammed down the lid on a heavy box.
I'm going to have to turn you in, Hagrid, Tom said. I don't think you meant to kill anyone, but...
You can't! Exclaimed Hagrid. You don't understand.
Yeah, that's Irish. No.
You don't understand!
The dead girl's parents will be here tomorrow. The least Hogwarts can do is make sure the thing that killed their daughter is slaughtered.
It weren't him, Hagrid pleaded. Aragog never killed no one. Never!
Monsters... Monsters don't make good pets, Hagrid. Now stand aside.
No!
The half-giant begged. Tom pointed his wand at the box.
System Aperio. With a flash of light, the lid of the box was blasted off, and Hagrid was flung to the ground. Instantly, a small-ish acromantula crawled out of the box and scuttled past Tom and out the door. As it went past, Tom cried out, "Aronia Exumai!" But his spell missed the creature by a wide margin. Jim's eyes narrowed.
Aragog!
Hagrid moved to follow the creature, but Tom stopped him and held his wand up threateningly.
I can't let you go, Hagrid. They'll snap your wand for this. You'll be expelled.
Hey, Tommy!
Jim interrupted loudly, as if certain Tom could hear him despite all evidence to the contrary.
You want to know a secret?
I know you Slytherins like to think that all Gryffindors are stupid lunkheads, but believe it or not, it just so happens that we can sometimes notice what happens right in front of us.
Tom did not respond, but continued to hold Hagrid at bay. Then Jim moved to stand between Tom and Hagrid so that he could see the boy's face.
I've already talked to Hagrid about these events, and he was convinced you didn't know Aragog was...
And he was convinced you didn't know Aragog was an acromantula until after he's...
And he was convinced you didn't know Aragog was an acromantula
until after he'd already been expelled.
Just now, though, I watched a 3-foot diameter spider go right. Just now, though. I watched a 3-foot diameter spider go right past you. You even used Aronia Exumai, which is a spell specifically designed for targeting spiders. Not that it mattered much, since I also saw you deliberately... Not that it mattered much, since I also saw you deliberately miss.
Jim fixed an angry stare on the other boy, who still seemed to pay him... Who still seemed to pay him no mind.
You knew Hagrid was innocent the whole time. You deliberately framed him.
Finally, Tom's eyes slowly moved. Tom's eyes slowly moved off of Hagrid to make contact with Jim's. He smiled cruelly.
Well, well, well. You are the clever lion, Potter. At least by the standards of your lunkhead house.
As he spoke, the memory of Hagrid faded away, along with all the furniture in the room.
What have you been doing to... What have you been doing to Ron Weasley? Jim asked in a cold, angry voice. Getting inside his head with lies like this?
Nothing so elaborate, Potter. Just basic emotional manipulation. Suppress his positive feelings for his family and friends. Heighten his natural insecurity, jealousy, and paranoia. Ironically, getting him to turn against his family was relatively easy. His love for them was no match for the feelings of low self-worth they unwittingly engendered within him with their mixture of unreasonable expectations. Feelings of low self-worth. Feelings of low self-worth they unwittingly engendered within him with their mixture of unreasonable expectations and benign neglect. Now the hard part, Potter, was getting him to turn on you.
Jim's eyes widened and Tom laughed.
At first, his entire sense of self-worth was bound up in his status as best friend of the boy who lived. Thankfully, you did a wonderful job of instilling a paranoia of all things Slytherin, all things Voldemort, and all things Serpentine into him. When you later revealed your parcel tongue ability, as well as the fact that you'd concealed it even from him despite your claims of friendship, that finally gave me the opening I needed. To assume total control. Ron Weasley is mine now to use as I see fit.
Jim stared grimly at Tom.
You're awfully free with your secret information, aren't you, Tom? Why shouldn't I be, Potter? He asked with a contemptuous sneer.
My plan was to distract you by blaming Hagrid. But I've got a fallback plan as well. You see, you've been in this memory long enough for me to trap you in here indefinitely. Your body will lie comatose until I release you. Then he laughed maliciously.
To Riddle's surprise, though, Jim's face registered neither surprise nor fear, but rather a righteous determination. He turned and walked out of the memory of Hagrid's room and down the hall. Then he turned to stand in front of a bare patch of wall, took a deep breath, and punched the wall with his fist as hard as he could. Thunk! The boy cried out in pain and shook his hand vigorously. Then he did it again. Thunk! Ouch! Riddle walked up next to him, laughing.
Of course. Of course. Typical Gryffindor. You actually think you can punch your way out?
Thunk! Jim paused and turned towards Riddle while massaging his now bloody hand.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a false memory palace, right? That's just a basic legitimacy trap.
Riddle suddenly stopped smiling, and Jim went back to punching the wall while he continued to talk.
And the way you break out of a false palace, thunk, is to find a solid wall and start punching it as hard as you can.
Thunk, shit.
Eventually, your desire to not feel your hand hurt anymore from punching the wall will be stronger than the legitimate's will to maintain the wall's durability.
Thunk. Thunk.
After that last punch, some of the plaster on the wall fell off and dropped to the ground, leaving a spiderweb of cracks behind. Jim turned back to the now scowling Tom Riddle with a smile.
And you know what's really funny, Tom? I learned all that out of a training manual written for Death Eaters.
The boy laughed and returns to punching the... The boy laughed and returns to punching his fist into the wall. The cracks were spreading noticeably. Riddle said nothing. Instead, he turned away and stared intently, as if looking at something some distance away.
Ron Weasley sat quietly at the table
in Percy's study room, fidgeting uncontrollably and occasionally sobbing. Every few minutes he stared at the clock on the wall, 9:50. Percy was supposed to be here at 10 o'clock to help him go over some astronomy homework. When he came, Ron would tell him everything he knew about the book. He feared that he would be expelled for being so stupid as to not recognize the book's danger, for letting it manipulate him for so long, and he honestly thought he should be expelled for the things he'd done as pranks that had been so destructive to everyone in the school, to say nothing of the things he thought he'd done but couldn't remember for sure, due to what he now knew were book-induced blackouts. In particular, he couldn't imagine what he'd ever do to make up for getting Fred kicked out of school. He remembered crying tears of genuine dismay over Fred's expulsion, and then suddenly all that stopped. He remembered his sadness melting away and how suddenly happy he was over Fred's expulsion, how satisfied he was to have destroyed his brother by manipulating Fred into taking the blame for a prank that he had performed. How funny he thought it all was. Now he just felt sick over it. Ron put his hands up to wipe the tears from his eyes.
I need you to let me back in, Ronald.
Ron looked up in terror.
Oh, wait, no.
Nah, yeah, this would just be totally full-on Tom.
Sitting across the table from him in Percy's chair was another Ron Weasley. It was like the mirror Weasley from his nightmare a few nights back, only there was no mirror now. His other self could practically reach out and touch him. Other Ron's expression was cold and cruel, and his eyes burned red.
No, Ron said shakily. Go away. Go away.
Please don't make this difficult for us both, Ronald. We've been through so much together this year. We've learned so much from one another. We've learned so much from one another. I wouldn't say that I'm actually fond of you, but it is not my desire to break you irrevocably, unless it's absolutely necessary. Or I suppose unless you try to thwart me, in which case I might take that personally. So just let me in now, without any resistance, and soon we'll be done with this.
We'll be done sooner than you think, Ron said defiantly. Jim has the book, and he'll figure you out. Or else get it to his dad at the DMLE and they'll figure you out. And in just a few minutes, Percy will be here, and I'm going to tell him everything.
Other Ron was silent for a few seconds before shaking his head almost sadly. See, Ron, that's the problem with you Gryffindors. Old bully and bluster. A Slytherin would have known better to tell someone... A Slytherin would have known better than to tell someone who's already under a tight schedule. A Slytherin would have known better than to tell someone who's already under a tight schedule that his time was shorter than he'd thought. Ron was confused by what other Ron was saying. Suddenly, to his surprise, Ron's body and arms suddenly became... Ron's body and arms became stuck to the chair as if with a sticking charm. He wasn't paralyzed, but he was definitely unable to move. Then he felt a strange rumbling in his stomach. After a few seconds, the boy felt the familiar watery tickle that preceded a bout of vomiting. But this was different. No bile came pouring up Ron's windpipe. Just an unnatural feeling in his chest of something crawling inside him. Ron's eyes widened in horror as his evil twin grinned delightedly. When some tiny wriggling object climbed up his throat and into his mouth, he reflexively spat it out onto the table. It was a wolf spider that bounced once on the table before quickly crawling away. Wild-eyed, Ron looked back at his doppelganger, who was leaning back in his chair as if to watch some amusing spectacle.
You bastard! He screamed. You damned... You damned bastard!
I've done this scene before.
His expletive was suddenly cut off into a crude gurgle as the rumbling returned, much stronger. His mouth was forced open by whatever foul magic the other Ron was using, and he could feel not one spider, but dozens or more crawling up his throat. He shook his head violently. He shook his head violently as they poured out of his mouth in waves. When he could draw breath, he just screamed hysterically. And then the next wave came, and the next, one app. And then the next wave came, and the next, one after another, and each producing more spiders than the last. Those he could spit out landed on the table or the floor. Most, however, simply crawled out of his mouth and up over his face or down into his clothes. By the fifth wave, something new was added, as tiny louse-sized spiders bypassed his mouth altogether, crawling up his nasal passages to exit through
crawling up through his nasal passages to exit through his nostrils. Let me end this. Let me end this, Ron, said other Ron, his voice full of compassion. It pains me to see you suffer like this. Just say yes. By now, Ron was almost past the point of coherent thought. He'd been afraid of spiders since the incident with the twins when he was a small child. But this was horror beyond compare. The part of Ron Weasley that was made of Gryffindor courage fought against the tide, but it was nothing compared to the crushing wave of pure terror that hit Ron every time more spiders crawled out of his screaming, gagging mouth. Finally, between waves of spiders and racking, terrified sobs, Ron gave in.
Yes! I'll do it! Just make it stop! Please! Just make it stop!
Back in the False Memory Palace, within Riddle's diary, Jim was making great progress.
Oh, no.
Back in the False Memory Palace, within Riddle's diary, Jim was making great progress. There were thick cracks in the wall around an indentation nearly 3 feet wide and 6 inches deep, where the brick and mortar had collapsed. After his last punch, the entire building seemed to shake for a second, and his hand hurt less and less with each blow. "Stop it, Potter," said Tom in a calm voice.
"Ha! Not a chance, Riddle. In a few minutes I'll be out of here. And within an hour, your little diary will be on my father's desk at the DMLE.
I think not, Tom said with sudden confidence. Jim paused at that and turned towards Tom to see that he had a wand out.
Oh, come on, Tom. You know that won't work. Keeping someone locked up in a false memory palace depends on making them believe the palace is real. Casting any kind of harmful spell on me while I'm in here would just make me wake up faster.
Tom smirked. That's very true, Jim. Of spells cast on you in here. Jim grew wary. Tom just smiled even more cruelly. Stupefy, he said in a childish sing-song voice and without waving his wand at all. Despite that, everything around Jim turned bright red, and his eyes rolled up back. His knees buckled, but before he could hit the ground, the boy's body vanished from the memory.
Gonna pause and save.
Ron Weasley looked down at the boy who... Ron Weasley looked down at the boy who was sprawled unconscious on the floor with a sinister smile. With a wave of his hand, the door to Jim's dorm room closed. Ron knelt to pick up Tom Riddle's diary off the floor to place it inside his backpack. Then he looked down and coldly regarded the real Ron Weasley's former best friend, who had come so close just now to defeating him.
No more defiance, Ronald, and no more playing around. Time for the end game.
With that, Ron Weasley bent over Jim's unconscious body and tugged on a lock of his hair before casting the cutting curse.
something.
The Hogwarts grounds, 1:30 p.m. The morning passed uneventfully to Harry, as did lunch, although he was a bit curious when Ginny pointed out that neither Jim nor Ron came down to eat. She wondered hopefully if, after the events of the previous night, Ron had decided to approach Jim and resolve their differences. Harry nodded without comment. He had a fairly negative opinion of Ron by this point, and if he'd been in Jim's shoes, he wouldn't give Ron the time of day. But he wasn't in Jim's shoes, and he knew that the two of he knew that the two had once had a deep friendship before the dueling club incident drove them thoroughly apart. After lunch, Harry and Theo headed off to the greenhouse for their first detention. They were soon joined by Neville and the Weasley twins. Neville was expected. He was eager to spend some quality time in the greenhouse to do some private work with his beloved plants after months spent quietly serving as Jim Potter's unofficial chaperone for most of every day. The twins, however, were a surprise. "Sir, what brings you two to our detention?" Harry asked. Can't get enough of the enticing bouquet of dragon dung?"
"Nah," said Fred. "We wanted to come along for moral support. Our way of saying thanks for helping to get me back to school."
Harry's eyebrows raised. "How did I do that?"
"Well, the way we hear it, you kept Lockhart busy enough for the... Nah. Well, the way we hear it... Well... Well... Nah. Well, the way we hear it... Well... Nah. Well, the way we hear it, you kept Lockhart busy enough for your dad to break down the door and witness his confession while I'm a Northern. Well, the way we hear it, you kept Lockhart busy enough for your dad to break down the door and witness his confession. If it hadn't been for you suddenly finding your inner Gryffindor, he'd have likely gotten away clean, and no one ever have known what he did to me."
Harry looked over at Fred curiously. He seemed to be taking the suggestion that he'd been under the Imperius curse surprisingly well. And Harry said so. "Honestly," said Fred, "I don't remember him doing anything, just me deciding it was a good idea to confess the prank. so George wouldn't get expelled for it. But if Lockhart confessed, he must have done it, right?" Harry nodded, but privately he wondered who Fred was trying to convince. For his part, George simply looked away, a fact that Harry also noticed. He decided to change the subject.
"St. Neville, since you're my herbology guru, maybe you can answer this for me," he began. "Professor Sprout has taught us a lot about how to cultivate mandrakes and what to use them for, but she's never mentioned what exactly they are or what they... But she's never mentioned what exactly they are or where they come from. I gather they're not actually tiny plant people. But why do they look like they are?
Fred laughed.
This is just like you were with the... This is just like you were with the garden gnomes last summer. Hey, Percy, are these things sentient?
Heh. He elbowed George, who smiled but didn't laugh. They're not sentient, Harry. Not even close to it. Normal Muggle mandrakes are the results of... Normal Muggle mandrakes are the roots of the Mandragora plant, and ancient Muggles used them for healing, though they're poisonous if you take too much. Sometime long ago, before the time of Hypatia... some wizard bred a subspecies of magical Mandragora... Some wizard bred a subspecies of magical Mandragora to use as potions ingredients. All the legends about mandrakes actually come from our... All the legends about mandrakes actually come from our magical version.
Okay, said Harry. But why did the mysterious wizard breed them...
so that they would imitate the human life cycle? Sprout said a few months back that they were acting like moody teenagers and that they'd probably be throwing wild parties soon.
Neville grimaced a bit and glanced towards the twins. Even though he'd shared a house with Fred and George for the better part of 2 years, he still didn't feel like he trusted them the way he did Harry, and the way Harry obviously trusted them. He took a deep breath.
Well, she was joking about the parties, I think. As for the rest, no one knows for sure, but the theory is that by making them look like tiny humans and giving them the ability to mimic certain human behaviors, he coughed diplomatically.
You get some of the benefits of incorporating a human sacrifice into your potion without actually killing anybody.
The other boys were suitably unnerved by that theory, but before they could ask anything more, the group turned the corner to that part of the grounds where the school's greenhouses were located. Just as they did, Harry saw Jim Potter come out of greenhouse number 3, the same one to which they were headed and where the mandrakes were housed. From a distance, the boy who lived turns to look... From a distance, the boy who lived turns to look at them with a surprisingly hateful expression. Neville called out to Jim, but the boy turned and walked quickly away without responding.
Huh, Neville said. I wonder what he was doing in there.
30 years and below are supposed to stay out of greenhouse number 3 now that... Nah.
30 years and below are supposed to stay out of greenhouse number...
30 years and below are supposed to stay out of greenhouse number 3 now... Ah.
30 years and below are supposed to stay out of greenhouse number 3 now that the mandrakes are nearly grown. Safety reasons and all that.
Except those of us with detention among the deadly killer plants, said Theo. And you for some inscrutable reason.
Neville laughed. I've got special permission
to help out with the mandrakes. Had to get a note from my gran due to the liability issues. My family already owns
one mandrake farm down in Australia, and gran would like to start another one.
And Graham would like to start another...
And Gran would like to start another somewhere closer to home after I graduate. But you have to be specially certified to get a license to run the Mandrake Farm, so I wanted to start as early as possible. By that point, the group had made it into greenhouse number 3. Immediately, the boys almost gagged from the smell. On the opposite side of the room were five 20-pound bags of dragon dung and 50 pots to put them in. Harry frowned and cast a bubblehead charm on himself before heading across the room. Halfway across, there was a soft flash of light. From the floor beneath his feet, and suddenly George Weasley... And suddenly George Weasley yelled at the top of his lungs,
"Harry, freeze! Don't take another step!" "Harry, freeze! Don't take another step!"
On model for the voice.
Startled, the others looked at him and saw that George's face had gone pale. He was staring in horror at Harry's feet, which they now noticed were surrounded by softly glowing runes he'd unwittingly stepped on. "Don't move a muscle until I tell you to," he continued before turning to
"Don't move a muscle until I tell you to,"
he continued before turning to Fred. "Get Neville and Theo away from here, at least 100 yards. Then find the first competent teacher you can and get them out of here as fast as... Drag them if you must."
"George, what..." Fred started. "Do as I say!"
George bellowed in a fury. Fred, who had never been spoken to that way by his twin, looked shocked for a second. Then he grabbed Neville and Theo by the scruff of their shirts and pulled them out of the room, both of them still calling Harry's name. George then carefully walked around the runes on the floor to... the other side so he could face Harry.
"George?" Harry said. "George?"
Harry said, quietly but nervously. "What's going on?"
"These are explosive runes, Harry,"
George said in a shaky voice. While he was trying to put on a brave face, it was obvious that George was terrified.
"I learned about it from Lockhart."
Harry paled.
"Exactly how explosive are we talking about?"
George studied the runes for a second and then looked round the greenhouse.
"With all this reactive dragon dung in here? Easily enough to blow up this whole building and everything in it.
"Uh-huh," he said. Harry looked down at the runes and then back at George.
"I don't seem to have exploded yet."
"They're timed," George said without looking up. "You've got just under a minute, but they'll go off instantly if you step off them. During the Grindelwald War, his Muggle servants dropped leaflets bearing these runes out of airplanes over wizarding settlements. If anyone touched the paper, boom." Harry nodded.
"Nice. And I don't suppose I'd be so lucky that you've actually learned how to disarm them?"
"No," said George in a soft voice. "You're not that lucky." Harry became surprisingly calm despite the news. Perhaps using occlumency had become reflexive in dangerous situations, or perhaps the sheer number of assassination attempts against him in the past year had just made him blasé. Right then, you'd better get out of here and find it. Right then, you'd better get out of here and find a teacher, preferably Snape. No offense, but I think we need Slytherin cunning in this instance rather than Gryffindor courage.
George looked up from the rooms towards the greenhouse's glass ceiling before taking a deep breath.
I can eat both, mate.
And then he stepped onto the rooms to stand right next to Harry.
What are you doing?
Harry hissed angrily. There's no sense in both of us dying.
Harry, shut up and do exactly as I say, George said.
He put his hand on Harry's shoulder. Okay, without moving your feet at all, bend your knees and go into a crouch. Harry did so as George matched him.
Good. Now, when I tell you to, start counting down from five, and when you get to zero, jump as high as you can. And once you get off the ground, tuck your legs in as much as possible.
Confused but desperate, Harry nodded, and when George gave the signal, he began counting down while George continued to grip his shoulder with one hand while bearing his wand aloft with the other. Just as Harry got down to one, George started his wand motion, and just as Harry said zero, George yelled out,
Protego Orbis!
As the two boys jumped up, the explosive runes flared to life. Simultaneously, George slashed his wand down, and a modified Protego shield shot down beneath them before wrapping itself up and around them into the shape of a protective sphere. A millisecond later, the runes erupted. Harry could see the flames all around them, even as the explosive force caused the sphere to shoot up like a cannonball through the glass ceiling. Greenhouse number 3 blew sky high, raining down broken glass and the screaming, mutilated remains of 50 burning mandrakes upon the area below. Luckily, no one was nearby to be harmed by the... Luckily, no one was nearby to be harmed by the plant's death cries. Nearly 1,000 feet above, George and Harry's protective orb reached its... George and Harry's protective orb reached its apogee and then fell back towards the ground. Inside, George hissed in pain from the stress of maintaining and controlling the shield despite the damage inflicted upon it. With some difficulty, he was able to slow the orb's descent and even pilot it so that it landed some distance away from the ruins of Greenhouse Number 3. Unfortunately, the two were still nearly 20 feet off the ground when his concentration finally broke. The two fell the rest of the way to Earth and landed... The two fell the rest of the way to Earth and landed rather hard. Harry heard a snap from somewhere in the vicinity of his left... Harry heard a snap from somewhere in the vicinity of his left... Harry heard a snap from somewhere in the vicinity of his left elbow. Then everything went black. Minutes later, students were gathering around... Minutes later, students were gathered around the fallen duo. Several prefects were on hand to make sure no one touched the two unconscious boys, though Marcus was quick to perform diagnostic charms to make sure they were not in imminent danger of death.
Somebody go get Madame Pomfrey, he yelled to the crowd. And while you're at it,
said Theo Knott with a murderous expression,
somebody find Jim Potter!
But no one did, at least not at first. For at that moment, the boy who lived was lying unconscious on the floor of a seldom-used broom closet on the top floor of Gryffindor Tower, bound, wandless, and completely oblivious to the trouble he was now in. End of chapter 40.
That's that, guys. That was a rough session. Ugh. Well, I'll say this, Ohana. When you say technique, what we actually mean is my dad composed a song for me to sing. That's what I did with Troublesome. That was an actual, like, I had like sheet music for that. The flowers, or not the flowers, the corn, some of that was composed. Like, their big song, a friend composed for me. It was like a 5-part harmony or something with like semitones and shit. And then the rest of it, like when the flowers are just kind of like speaking, oh, let me